My name is Lee, and I will be your host, as per usual, here on the Amandla program on KALX Berkeley 90.7 FM. And I'm here today with Andrea Irvin from the Berkeley College Republicans, who were recently featured in, I believe it was an SF Weekly story.
Yeah, it was.
Okay. So, Andrea, you are the president of Berkeley College Republicans, is that correct?
That's true.
Okay. Now, I'm going to warn you, you are probably the second Republican I've had on the show.
Okay.
The first was David K. Johnston, who wrote the book Perfectly Legal. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I'm not, but
he talks a bit about tax code, but he tries to hide his Republicanism because he's a journalist.
So. Oh, well, he shouldn't.
Okay. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? You moved up here from Thousand Oaks as a freshman coming to Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest is history?
Not really. I actually joined many different clubs when I first got here, at least superficially so. Any typical freshman who comes here and signs up for 8 or 9 different activities and doesn't really know quite what it is that's going to grab their attention. So I signed up, to be perfectly frank, for both the Libertarian and the Republican group, and actually ended up leaning towards the Republican group the more I stayed here and became actively involved, like my second semester. So I really, I think, took a shining to the group and haven't ever left since.
So what attracted you to a Republican group on campus?
The issues that they were concerned with, the issues at the time, especially I think being a freshman after 9/11, definitely hit home for me. I really felt that the people in the club shared a lot of my viewpoints on political issues, on issues relating to healthcare and the economy, and in a lot of ways, going to meetings felt like finally having an honest discussion on campus and really a place that, you know, my viewpoints could be heard without any kind of, jeering or, mm-hmm. Pure contempt. So that was a lot of my affection for the group.
Okay. Well, I get a little bit confused in that.
Sure.
But just in reading the article, it mm-hmm. seemed like most of the, and this may be an error in the mm-hmm. article that you'd want to correct, but it seemed that most of the people they talked to in the Berkeley College Republicans had at one time or another felt themselves to be more liberal-minded or to be, in the article, they said that many of you seem to have started from a liberal viewpoint and moved over towards a more right-wing position.
Well, I think that being a Republican, being a part of the Republican Party and a Republican group on campus doesn't mean that we all share the same viewpoints. So a lot of the people in the club have been Republicans all their lives, and they've grown up with Republican parents, and just like any, there are plenty of Democrats on that side who grow up with Democrat parents and are raised as Democrats and have known their political affiliations for 7 or 8 years now. And there are a lot of people in the group, for instance, myself, who I think started out much more Libertarian prior to my arrival in Berkeley. I know Omri Gallet, who was also featured in the article and is originally from France, also started from a more liberal background. And
But you say liberal and libertarian. Do you see those?
He was okay. Yeah. Well, I apologize. I don't mean to. I ended up being Libertarian, so
okay.
Fiscally conservative, socially liberal. He was, registered Democrat, essentially. So he was coming from a much more liberal environment, obviously being from Europe and from France, and his parents, bringing him up in that environment. He was more liberal than myself at a younger age, and when he came here, became a conservative.
Okay. And so what, what sort of brought you over from, for you it was a libertarian perspective, but what brought you over to a more Republican view? And I guess piggybacking on that question, because you mentioned that not all of you have similar beliefs, I'm wondering where you feel you depart from traditional Republican or current Republican thought.
Okay. I think as far as the transition, and this is a question I get asked frequently, and it's difficult to pinpoint. I don't think anyone suddenly wakes up one day and says, I'm going to change my party affiliation today.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that happens over time, and it's something that, it's subtle observation over the course of many months. And for me, being in Berkeley is, challenges. It's a place where you know, you're supposed to look at your viewpoints, be open-minded about your thoughts, your political feelings. And I challenged myself a lot to think about the issues that I held dear. And over the course of my first semester and into my second semester, I really, you know, thought a lot about what I felt was important politically, what I felt was important both for myself and for the country, and became more conservative. You know, talked a lot with people both in the club and people who didn't agree with the club, and really, you know, challenged myself to see what it is that I thought was right, and you know, searched for it. I think a lot of people in the club do the same and do it on a daily basis. And you're going to have to redo
that said, yes. You know, where do you fall on some of the major issues that that are part of, you know, modern republicanism? I mean, you say that you don't agree with them 100%, and we've had a liberal commentator on before where I also sort of posed the same question, like,
sure.
where do you depart from the party line?
Yeah, it's probably on very minor points. I'll say that I tend to toe the party line, obviously on fiscal issues relating to taxes, small government. I definitely tend towards the Republican area, states' rights, things of that nature. Places where I think I take somewhat of a departure is that even though I do believe in as minimal government as possible, there is no way to do without government, and government does have a place in a lot of situations. And I think being an economics major, and being at Berkeley, I think I've learned to see a lot of the, you know, positive externalities in what government and public consumption can do. But I think for the most part, I do toe the party line on a great many issues, but maybe with slight variations on how to get things done as opposed to the actual issue itself.
Okay. So in terms of the tax code, I mean, you feel as though there needs to be more tax relief? Is that
more tax cuts?
Tax cuts?
Yes.
Okay, that's where I would take issue, just
sure.
in that... you know, David K. Johnston was on the program recently, and his whole documentation, and, you know, he's been endorsed by Lou Dobbs as well as many, you know, many liberal and conservative commentators have said, we may not agree with his conclusions, but the facts are there. And he basically says that if you look at the tax code, it's weighted such that as you move up in income, you pay less and less and less taxes until if you do the top 1%, there's, you know, no taxes virtually because of the many loopholes that people are able to receive. And that, in fact, if you look at the number of audits, more audits are being done on, you know, people on welfare and, you know, to verify the earned income tax credit. I mean, that seems to me like there's a need for some relief on the bottom end, not so much on the middle or even the top. I mean, how do you respond to that?
Sure. I actually think secretly, and it's not obviously an issue that's ever going to happen. Most Republicans probably want to see a flat tax and get rid of loopholes. I know Tom McClintock, who you know, was in the governor's race for a while there, was a champion of this because his thought was the simpler the tax code and the more equal, the better. And for him, everyone paying the same percentage of their income was equality, and closing loopholes that allow, you know, the top, you know, 1% to escape a lot of the same taxes that the lower part are paying was a fair system. And that's the system I'd like to see. However, that being said, it's never going to happen, so okay. I should probably stop wishful thinking there. So
how do you feel about the fact that, you know, one of the big things that Bush ran on was cutting the estate tax?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there were stories of him talking about, you know, all the family farms in the Midwest that were going to be killed by the estate tax, yet it's been documented that there were no family farms in the Midwest that were damaged by the estate tax. I mean, I'm wondering how what you're saying about your view of a good tax plan meshes with what we're actually seeing now.
Whether it's actually equal in that sense.
Right.
Yes. I actually think that in the end, the main philosophy behind getting rid of the estate tax is to say, individual's property is their property. To tax things, you know, two or three times over the course of a lifetime, you know, these people have been paying property taxes on their estates over many, many, many years, have been paying taxes on their income, taxes on their assets for their entire lifetime. To tax it again after it's been inherited, after they've passed away, you know, or for, you know.
But in point of fact, though, in implementation, it's only, it only benefits, you know, the very top 1% of people.
Sure, and it's not, that is not, I think, like I said, that wasn't the point.
Right.
It doesn't matter if that's what was said for the point of politicking. What I'm saying is that the philosophy behind it goes back to property rights, individuals, you know, right to own their own assets and not be done, you know, taxed four or five times.
Right.
So I think it's not, I'm saying that there's a lot of spin, obviously, on this issue because, you know, there's been such a demonization of the rich over the course of the last 40 years that it's gotten to the point that even Republicans are trying to downplay the, you know, point of being rich. And that, I don't agree with that either. I don't think that the rich are evil, but, you know, a lot of politicking happens about the rich. So.
Well, I guess I wouldn't say that, you know, anybody who's rich is inherently evil. You know, I've read about, you know, Warren Buffett's plans for actually reinstating a larger property tax in California and actually increasing inheritance taxes on the idea that, you know, decreasing inheritance taxes basically says if you had rich parents, you get a free ride.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Warren Buffett, George Soros, other wealthy people who I definitely very much agree with. But when I look at the current administration and sort of some of the back scratching that seems to go on, like with Dick Cheney and Halliburton, I mean, how do you address concerns of that sort?
Concerns of back scratching?
Well, of I mean, many people have talked about Dick Cheney's relationship with Halliburton, and it's actually come up in the news again recently. Just today, I think there was a news story about memos that have come out of the Pentagon where they were asking for approval from Dick Cheney before they would actually before they finalized any deals with Halliburton before going into Iraq. I mean, and whether you can comment on that specifically, I don't know. But in terms of, I mean, those stories have been out there for quite some time about Dick Cheney's relationship with Halliburton, and they are the biggest contractor in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Does that give you any? Does that concern you at all? Or,
you know what? This is where I should say it does, but it doesn't, because a lot of politics is about how you benefit the people who've been good to you,
mm-hmm.
and you know, for Dick Cheney, it's, you know, certain constituencies, and for the Democrats, it's others. So. You know what? Everyone who's in politics is in it to back scratch each other. And that's a very cynical view on life. But the press has taken a liking to demonizing the oil companies and I think taking a very negative viewpoint of that relationship between the presidency and the oil companies and, you know, vice president as well. But in essence, the Democrats over the years, as has other Republican administrations, taken, you know, favoritism towards certain groups and certain constituencies in their presidencies. And there's just no way around that. It's been going on for hundreds of years. And, you know, so this happens to be a bit prominent. Well, it doesn't mean it's never happened, and it doesn't mean it's not ever going to happen again in both Democrat and Republican administrations to come. So
I would acknowledge Brown and Root got their start with mm-hmm. Lyndon Johnson.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it seems that there's a certain amount of secrecy around, you know, like the Greenhouse Emissions Commission that Dick Cheney formed, that currently there's a Supreme Court case around whether he needs to release the names of the people who were part of that. You mentioned the media attacking sort of the oil companies earlier. Do you feel, as some have said, that there's a liberal bias in the media?
I think to some extent there is. I don't know that it's as... it's not always as attacking as I think a lot of pundits on the right would like to think it is, but it's subtle, and that's where you know, people who are Republicans or who tend to lean right, who see it in the media, tend to feel a little more defensive about it. It's not, if it was so overt and attacking that you could pinpoint a question and say, yes, see, don't you see that this is where the media has put a spin on this issue? But it's not. It's, you know, so embedded in the article. It's so subtle in the questioning and where questions are led and how interviews are led that it's almost so difficult for your average person who just reads the paper every day to find out what's going on to really see. And
so how do you respond to the recent apology made by the New York Times about the fact that there was ample evidence at the time that they had certain reporters who were not black, like Jason Blair, but who basically were not doing due diligence in researching their stories and supporting the march to war, claiming that there were weapons of mass destruction when there clearly are not, using as sources only people who are very close to the administration. And Daniel Okrent actually wrote an editorial today basically saying that the New York Times failed and was overly supportive of the administration's aims. And the New York Times is one of the biggest focal points of the right's ire about liberal mm-hmm. media.
Yeah, certainly the op-ed pieces in the New York Times are not...
Well, those are editorials.
Not always support, yes. As far as the articles and that controversy, I think there is definitely a pressure in the media, and you know, I'm not saying that every article is biased, but there's also a pressure in the media to give the public what it wants. So I think the New York Times is responding more to the pressure from, you know, that sense that this is what our viewers or our readers want from us. And you could saw it in both CNN and Fox News after 9/11. They wanted to give their viewers something patriotic, something to rally around, something that inspired them to watch. And
but isn't it really their job to give the viewers the truth?
It's their job to be objective and to give as much information as possible. And I think that, you know, any news source that's giving in to this pressure to tell its readers only what they want to hear and what they want to see is definitely a disservice to the public. And
so how do you feel about Fox?
How do I feel about Fox News? Oh, well, I'm actually a CNBC girl myself.
Okay.
So I think, this is the economist in me again. I think the economy is highly important, and I think people should put an effort into understanding what business and the economy is doing, because I think not enough people actually know how it works. And you end up with a lot of interesting information off of that particular channel. Fox News, I think, has especially... given into the "I am going to give the audience what it wants"
right.
Mentality, but I also dislike CNN a lot as okay. well. I just find them to be overly sentimental in their mentality, but in a different way. So,
so even Aaron Brown, you find have you watched it? I feel like he's a raging right wing commentator. That's just me. You know, he was very much on the march to war.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, how do you feel about the fact that do you support the war effort? Do you support the fact that we're there? Even though there no weapons of mass destruction have been found? And actually, before you answer that,
sure.
For legality's sake, I have to say you're listening to KALX Berkeley 90.7 FM. This is the Amandala program. My name is Lee, and I'm here with Andrea Irvin from the Berkeley College Republicans. So back to the question.
Sure.
I mean, how do you feel about the fact that we're in Iraq based on the notion that there were these weapons of mass destruction and there's no weapons of mass destruction?
Sure. A troubling issue, to say the least. I actually am definitely supportive of the war on terror. I'm supportive of the war specifically in Iraq. I actually read an interesting piece today. Anyone who goes to National Review online, there's an interesting editorial about the war in Iraq, and it actually relates it to the Battle of Britain in World War II, and I know that's kind of a Memorial Day weekend. But the point was that it's actually, even though we're calling it a war in Iraq, it's actually a battle for a greater good, I think. There's a definite need for a democracy other than Israel in the Middle East.
But why is that our job? Why is that America's job?
Well, unfortunately, because America is the only superpower left in the world, we're the only ones with the true capability of doing these things across the world. And we have been doing it for ages. We went into Bosnia when they were having problems. That's not our job either. And yet Clinton sent us there.
Right.
You know.
No, I didn't agree with that either.
Just stay out of it entirely is the...
Well, I mean, it's not... I don't... And in fact, I think it was Bush, while he was campaigning, was saying, we are not the world's policemen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what about... It seems
it's,
to me there were
the
ulterior motives.
When he was campaigning. And it's not going to be. And I don't think that he or Clinton ever saw this coming. I don't even want to get into the whole commission, but no one knew that the world was going to change quite so dramatically and at such a sudden moment. And you know,
go ahead. Okay, sorry.
Go ahead. Just, no, it's fine. Go.
I just because of the premise there that the world changed so dramatically, mm-hmm. there's been the argument pretty consistently that, you know, we've squandered a lot of the goodwill that we had right after 9/11. You know, the French newspapers with headlines saying, we are all Americans now, and now you've got, you know, the Cannes Film Festival giving the Palme d'Or to a documentary, which they never do, for Michael Moore, who... as much as I like what he says most of the time, is not the greatest filmmaker. you know, how do you respond to how, I mean, does that make any sense to you?
It does make sense to me. Luckily, I don't really like France that much, so this doesn't concern me one bit that they don't like us. In fact, it's probably a better sign that they don't, because at least I feel like we're doing something right in that respect. But I think that France has its own issues of hypocrisy to deal with, especially concerning oil contracts and
well,
politics.
Certainly. They had oil contracts in Iraq.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, no one's clean on this particular issue, and I don't agree with politics in France very much. So, again...
Well, I mean, separate from France, you know...
The world as a whole.
The world as a whole. I mean, most people do not feel safer... now, even with the Patriot Act and everything else that's going on.
Well, I don't think that anyone in the Bush administration, or I think most Americans, really believe that this, you know, I'm going to feel safer mentality is going to happen overnight. And it's something that it's going to take a very long time. And it's something that I think as Americans we need to buckle down to, because it's not going to be a 3-month stay. And I don't think that Bush has any intention of leaving before this job is finished, despite the pressure he's getting from the media, from, you know, other sources, and also from Europe. But it is going to take a long time. This is not an easy task, making the Middle East a place that's stable. And who knows if it can be done, but it's certainly worth a try to get a democracy flourishing there.
Well, my concern is more with what's going on here, I
mm-hmm.
think, is why I mentioned the Patriot Act and concerns around that. I mean, I just feel like it's a very scary time, not only if I wanted to travel mm-hmm. in the world, but also here at home with some of the overzealous terrorist prosecutions that are mm-hmm. going on. You know, we have a story that I'm going to run, actually... probably should run in about a minute, about a white middle-class art professor in New York who recently was arrested on suspicion of biological terrorism because he had genetic testing equipment in his home that was readily available for purchase anywhere. I mean, don't you worry that maybe we're giving up a little too much for this?
No. And here's my little spiel on the Patriot Act. Despite, I think, what people are afraid of in it, they're actually only variations on laws that have been in existence for decades. The actual Patriot Act itself is just a compilation of changes to other laws, and changes, I might add, that really are not all that drastic when compared to the original laws. They're actually just the wording has been changed so that they can go after subjects, you know, terrorist subjects. But in essence, the grounds by which someone can be arrested for a quote unquote, you know, terrorist act is based on the same evidence as was needed before it was called the Patriot Act. And I can't speak to this sense of greater safety because we live in an open society. It's not safe. It's not going to be safe. And that's the price we pay for being a democracy. You know, we're going to have open borders and we're going to have, you know, planes that might be able to be hijacked, but we're a free and democratic society, and that's kind of how it goes.
Well, I hope that we continue to be, is all I can say. And thank you for joining us, Andrea. Maybe
not a problem.
We'll have you back again, maybe when school starts up.
Sure.
So, next up, we have a story about an email press release that has been circulating the web this past week, detailing the story of art professor Steve Kurtz's detainment by the FBI at his home in New York after he called police to report the death of his wife,